Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It is great to have your company this morning. Many of us know that civil rights icon Rosa Parks refused to give up a seat on a municipal bus in Montgomery, Alabama, an incident that resulted in her arrest and sparked a year-long boycott of the bus system there. But relatively few people are familiar with Rosa Parks' long history of activism that came before the bus boycott and her political involvement in the half-century that followed. A new book by Brooklyn College professor and Milwaukee native Jane Thea Harris sheds much more light on the story of Rosa Parks. Thea Harris joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich on the line from New York back in February and said then that seeing Parks only in terms of her actions in Montgomery is to miss a great deal about her.
My book is titled The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, and in part, I did that to highlight the kind of scope of her political life, right? That the Montgomery bus boycott and her bus arrest is a very important part of that, but it is only one of many points in her life of a kind of a life of political activism, a life of lived-in struggle.
Well, and you're right that there has been something to be gained from some people in and around the civil rights movement and outside of it from keeping Rosa Parks in this particular box.
I think in terms of how, as a nation, this history, this popular narrative works, right? It's a very happy, feel-good kind of children's story version. This woman makes this single act, and it galvanizes the nation, and then we have the civil rights movement with Martin Luther King, and then we get a Civil and Voting Rights Act, and then it's done. And that's a very happy story, and I think it both misses the what it took to make this movement, and that many things were not resolved and continued to be, you know, many issues of racial injustice continue on, and therefore that Rosa Parks and many of her colleagues continued on after 1965 to address social inequality, to address police brutality, to address the need for Black history in the curriculum, to address the war in Vietnam, right? That these are pressing issues. And so the actual Rosa Parks works on those, but the narrative we have is it makes us feel good about ourselves because it is a very it has a nice arc and it has a nice happy ending.
Well, and so let's talk about the real Rosa Parks. Mm-hmm. Where and when were the seeds actually sown for her activism? The Montgomery bus boycott was not the beginning of her life in this world. When did it start for her?
Well, I think there are a number of seeds. The first seed is certainly her family. She is raised by her mother and her grandparents, and both her mother and in particular her grandfather have this real political spirit. Her grandfather is a supporter of Marcus Garvey, and they very much raise her to be respectable, but part of that respectability is to demand respect from others, right? And to be proud and, you know, have this kind of spirit about her. So I think the first seed is certainly how she is raised. I think the second seed, she marries Raymond Parks, who she describes as the first real activist I ever met. And Raymond Parks, when she meets him in 1931, is working on the Scottsboro case. That's the case of 9 young African-American men who had been arrested for riding the rails. That charge changes very quickly to rape. They are sentenced to death. And so this support committee in which and Raymond Parks is taking part in this movement kind of comes up to sort of free and defend the Scottsboro boys. So I would say that's the second seed. Is sort of in many ways her political development as an adult begins alongside her husband sort of around the Scottsboro case. And the third seed, in 1943, Rosa Parks wants to register to vote, and she sees a picture in the Black newspaper of an NAACP meeting, and she sees a classmate in the picture, and she realizes that women can be part of the organization, and so she goes to a meeting. And she's the only woman there that day. Her friend is not there, and she is elected secretary of the branch. And she and a small group of other African-Americans, including a man by the name of E.D. Nixon, worked to transform the Montgomery NAACP into a much more activist branch. And so she will spend the decade before her bus arrest sort of traveling Alabama, taking affidavits of white brutality, of legal malfeasance, right? So she has this sort of whole courageous history even before we get to December 1st, 1955, when she's arrested on the bus.
Well, and she does have this whole history, but at the same time, it seems like the myth of Rosa Parks is already building leading up to the bus boycott and her arrest. How did the myth of Rosa Parks as this, you know, both an activist but also a quiet, unassuming person originate?
Mm-hmm. December 1955, right? We are in the midst of a Cold War in the United States, and we are in the midst of a kind of that civil rights activism of any sort tends to get red-baited, and it tends to get seen as the work of outsiders. Parks herself, but many of the sort of civil rights activists in Montgomery, as the boycott gathers momentum. So at first, the boycott is just a one-day boycott, and then it is so incredibly successful that the community decides to take it forward as a kind of, you know, an indefinite boycott. Immediately, she's accused of being a communist, and she's accused of being an NAACP plant. White segregationists like have all of these rumors about her. And so in many ways, this kind of image of her as this kind of quiet seamstress is in part a myth that is born in those early days of the boycott to keep the movement safe. Oddly, these segregationists don't realize at the time that she does have this actual real history with the NAACP. They don't seem to know that, but they sort of are accusing the movement of being the work of outside agitators. And she is not, obviously, an outside agitator. In some sense, her political life gets backgrounded for the safety of the movement.
So the bus boycott kind of vaults her into a more prominent role or prominent view within the civil rights movement. In the wake of the bus boycott, how did the broader civil rights movement treat Rosa Parks?
Part of what happens, 1 month into the boycott, Rosa Parks loses her job. She's an assistant tailor at the biggest department store downtown, and she loses her job. And her husband, Raymond, also loses his job. He's a barber at the Air Force Base, and they forbid any talk of the boycott or that woman in the shop. And for, again, a proud man like Rosa Parks' husband, Raymond, that's untenable. So they spend basically the boycott. I mean, she sews a little bit on the side. He barbers a little bit on the side. But they do not have steady work. And even after the boycott ends, they can't find steady work. They continue to get death threats to their home. And so 8 months after the boycott ends, they are forced to leave Montgomery for Detroit. Because they are in a very sort of bad situation. There had been this kind of, in the Montgomery Improvement Association, this whole controversy flares up that spring about giving Rosa Parks a job. But she and Edie Nixon, right, who she has been a long time organizing with, are sort of on the outside, and so she is not given a job. And so she leaves for Detroit in 1957, and then she will spend the second half of her life and her political life in Detroit, sort of working against sort of racial inequality in Detroit.
Right, because Detroit turns out not to be really any better in a lot of ways than mm-hmm. Alabama.
Right, right, right. So she calls it the promised land that wasn't. Like sort of the signs of public segregation are gone. The systems of segregation in housing and schools and jobs are still there, and obviously also police brutality. And so she says she doesn't find that much difference. And so like she had in Montgomery, she sets about to sort of be involved and to try to change and challenge sort of racism in her new hometown.
But it sounds like within the bigger civil rights movement, and I don't know that you ever come out and say it in so many words, there's still a fair amount of, I'll just say it, sexism at work, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. there was a lack of inclusiveness of women despite the role that they were playing either behind the scenes or up front.
Right. I mean, I think that manifests itself in multiple ways. I think it manifests itself at the March on Washington. No woman speaks at the March on Washington. Rosa Parks and a handful of women are asked to stand up, which I think many find galling, including Parks. That here, women have played this huge role in the struggle and yet are being kind of relegated to the side. For her personally, it has these costs in terms of people not recognizing her need, that she, for the better part of a decade, the Parks family has sort of significant economic problems that stem from her bus arrest. And yet, It is not till John Conyers hires her in 1965 that she gets any kind of paid political position. And he hires her. She works. She volunteers. Conyers is running for the first time for this new congressional seat in Michigan in 1964, and she volunteers on his campaign. He's a young civil rights lawyer. He's out against the war in Vietnam. She is also opposing U.S. involvement in Vietnam. And she helps get King to come to Detroit on behalf of Conyers. And Conyers very much credits that as sort of raising his profile. He wins the primary by less than 100 votes. And so one of the first things he does is he hires Rosa Parks. That's 1965. This is 10 years after her bus arrest. And so this decade of suffering, as I talk about in my book, right, I think is in part, it's hard that people don't fully recognize that suffering at the time, in part because of her gender, as you mentioned.
And every once in a while, there are efforts, you know, she is in Jet magazine and in various newspapers, people writing about how she's kind of been cast to the side.
Right. Jet magazine does this sort of cover story in 1960 on the bus boycott's forgotten woman. She gets ulcers during the boycott that sort of plague her. She ends up in the hospital. They are still having trouble finding work. They are in this sort of two-room, very tiny apartment, her husband Raymond, and her mother. This is a very hard time for them. And so Jet magazine does this kind of, you know, almost an expose of it. And that does succeed in getting some help for her. And finally also the NAACP steps in at that point. She, you know, their family was in very difficult shape. And she's very proud. So obviously she doesn't like to talk about sort of what that part of it and that need. But it's a very hard part of the story, I think.
Well, and I think you write early on in this book that it sounds like it's challenging to access many of Rosa Parks' own writings. And so you, I gather, were forced to work from contemporaneous accounts and you know, her correspondence that's in the possession of others. It must be hard to get a sense for, over the years, how she viewed her own role throughout this period.
As you mentioned, part of her papers are at Wayne State, but a large portion of her papers are still caught up. They're actually at an auction house here in New York, and they have not been sold, and no scholar has been allowed to see them, to evaluate them, or anything. So, as you say, I was forced to rely on both the papers that she had donated in the 70s to Wayne, as well as letters and other people's papers. And also, she gave many, many interviews and oral histories over the years. And unfortunately, those interviewers tend to ask similar questions. But because there were so many interviews, I was able to also look at the kind of margins of those interviews, of kind of what she's saying that they're not necessarily fully picking up on. Right, so they're kind of asking the same kinds of questions. But if you listen to her closely, and this is what I try to do in the book, to kind of use her words to kind of get a sense of what she's thinking about at the time. And those interviews really spanned the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, you know, so, and then all the way to the end of her life, so that we can get a sense of what Rosa Parks is, for instance, thinking about when she's interviewed in the late 60s. A number of oral histories are done in the late 60s with her. And again, they don't ask the questions that you or I would want known now, right? They very much don't ask about her political work in Detroit, for instance. But they, you know, they are a fairly rich resource in terms of thinking about how she saw her role in Montgomery and her bus arrest and her views on self-defense and her views on the 1967 Detroit riot. So some of that can be gleaned from those interviews.
Do you think, is there something bigger at stake than just illustrating history from breaking down this essentially one-dimensional image of Rosa Parks?
Oh, I think there's something huge at stake. I mean, in many ways, I think Rosa Parks is a national hero. One might argue a national saint, right? She lies in the Capitol. She's the first woman, second African-American, first civilian to lie in honor in the Capitol when she dies in 2005. I mean, this is a national story. This is a national fable. And it's about her and her courage, but it's really reduced to one act on one day. And it's very much used to, I think, put the movement in the past and to say racism is over. And I think a fuller look at her life and her history, I think, forces us to confront sort of a much different set of truths about the United States, both in terms of the enduring kind of nature of racial and social injustice, of the fact that she had continued to work and press on these issues all the way to the end of her life, that she in no way thought the movement was over, that there had certainly been successes, but there was much more work to be done. So, I mean, absolutely, I think changing the story about Rosa Parks, I think, changes what, if we're going to honor her legacy, what honoring that legacy requires of us, you know, as people and as a nation.
Well, Jean Theo Harris, you have painted a really textured picture for us, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jean Theo Harris is a professor of political science at Brooklyn College in New York and is a Milwaukee native. Her book is called The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. It's published by Beacon. She first spoke to Mitch Tyke in early February. Rosa Parks would have turned 100 on February 4th of this year. Theo Harris will be in town to talk about Rosa Parks later this month. On April 24th, she'll speak at UW-Milwaukee, and on April 25th, she'll be at Marquette University. There are links to more information about both presentations at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up after a break, we'll get up close and personal with a particular bird of prey. We'll find out who when Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.